So we have been studying, welcome to our newcomers, we've been studying this year values, Jewish values, and how we think about these values in the context of the Holocaust and in the museum. So last time we spoke about courage, and this time I want to talk about another very Jewish value. One way to think about this value is in light of the following rabbinic text. There is a collection of teachings of the rabbis that is edited in and around the year 230. So you're talking about an ancient text. We call it the Mishnah, which means it's a collection of teachings over the course of several centuries that was edited by a great rabbinic authority, Rabbi Yehuda, the prince, in the 3rd century. In this corpus of knowledge is a particular tractate which is referred to as Pirkei Avot. We got some nods. Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot is a section, it's a segment of a much broader corpus. What's that?
Saying of our fathers.
Right. Ethics of our fathers, sayings of our tradition.
I'm going to say ethics of our ancestors.
Yes, ethics of our ancestors. It's a very important work, Pirkei Avot. Lots of different aspects of personal character development that are expressed in Pirkei Avot. Now, in the end of the first parak, there is a statement that is attributed, the Mishnah tells us that one particular person used to say this. Now, it's not just that he said this. The Mishnah says, Hu Haya Omer, which is literally translated as? Right. So what does it mean that he used to say? That's right. Exactly. So this is a statement that doesn't just convey a teaching, it conveys a motto, a mantra, a focus. This man's name was Hillel. So Hillel was a very important rabbinic sage. Hillel used to say the following, Im ein ani li mi li, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? Uch sha'al ni la'atzmi mo ani. But if I am for myself, then what am I? Now, how do we understand what exactly is Hillel trying to say with this compound teaching, complex teaching? How do we understand this? So one way to think about this is, in a certain sense, the two models that we can use are actually two visions that our patriarch Abraham had about how the future of the Jewish people is going to develop. On the one end, we were told that we're going to be like stars. And on the other hand, we are told that we're not going to be like stars, we're going to be like?
Sand.
That's right, grains of sand. And you use these two models and you say, stars, wait a second, a star, that's a big source of energy and light which is distinct, unique. Had a special privilege, thanks to a sale from the airlines, that I got to take my wife for her birthday to Los Angeles. We had never gone to L.A. Went to Los Angeles. We went for a day and a half, that's about a safe amount of time to leave 5 children to fend for themselves. I'm just kidding. We had childcare, don't worry. But we go to L.A. Now, we didn't go there, but apparently there's the place called the Walk of Fame, where there's stars. You know, everybody has their own star. That's a very, you would say in Yiddish, that's a chosh of a zach. You know, that's a very big thing. You get a star, you're a somebody. So Abraham is told their children are going to be like stars. They're going to be a somebody. And yet, we mentioned before that every year we go to see my in-laws. We go to Florida. You go to the beach. Billions of grains of sand? Probably, right? Billions, I suspect. More than millions, right?
Trillions.
Trillions. You look at one grain of sand, you drop it in a cup of water, it's nothing. So what is Abraham being told? That on the one hand, his children, his descendants are going to be like grains of sand. On the other hand, they're going to be like stars. Hillel is saying, If I'm not focused on me, then what am I? It's all about making me, being me, promoting me, developing me. And yet he says, if it's about me, I'm nothing. So one of the great groups of Hasidim in pre-war Poland was a group known as the Gerer Hasidim. Ger tiny town, huge influence. So the Ger Rebbe before the war, his name was Rav Yehuda Leib Alter. That was his name. And he collected, he had a tremendous number of teachings, which he and his students collected in several volumes called Sfas Emes, The Language of Truth. And he has a phenomenal, phenomenal explanation of this, which is really the heart of the character trait that we want to explore today together. He says, what Hillel is trying to tell you is that on the one hand, every individual is given unique talents and abilities and created and put on this earth at a specific time in a specific place, and only that person can fulfill that role in this world. No one else can do that. No one else can be that friend or can be that parent or can be that mentor. No one else. So Hillel says, Im ein ani li, if I don't figure out and pursue my role in this world, then ma'ani, what am I? But uchesha'ani la'atzmi, if I define my role as a selfish one, as one which is about me, then I'm nothing. I'm only a star if I develop my personal talents in the service of something greater. But if I make my life about me, I'm going to end up like a grain of sand. This is what we could call the midah, the character trait of selflessness. This is a core Jewish value, that when we think about the focus of our lives, our goal is to focus on the greater, on the other, on something much bigger than ourselves. And that inspires true heroism, spiritual heroism. There was a book that I did not get a chance to read yet, but it's called, it just came out a few months ago, it's called The Plateau. It's a study of resistance in southern France, of people who rescued Jews, hid Jews. And these people, by the way, they were recognized by Yad Vashem as righteous among the nations, the local parish priest and a bunch of families. One of the reviews of this book I saw was in, I think it was in the journal, the title of the review was something about living selflessness. That was the title. The concept of hiding Jews at that time, first of all, was an anomaly, unfortunately. We know that. You know, of the 700 million people living in Europe, how many of them hid Jews? There were some, but it was unquestionably an anomaly. But to do that is to think beyond yourself, beyond what's good for me. It's what is going to make a difference in humanity, what's going to make a difference in this other person's life. I saw a couple of years ago an amazing, amazing documentary about a group of Polish women, Gentiles, who had access to the ghetto in Warsaw. And they had an underground network of smugglers who their mission was to take children out of the ghetto and find them places to live and resettle them, ultimately save their lives. Yeah, I think that was the name. And it was so painful because one of the women described how the children were often angry at them. And they said, why did you take me away from my parents and take me home? Stuff like that. And it's like, tears your heart out. And some of these women, they described in the documentary, were caught by the Gestapo and they were tortured. They were killed. So why did they do that? It's unbelievable. They had no self-interest. What is it going to help them for? They didn't get money. They didn't get, as you say in Yiddish, they didn't get covered. They didn't get honor. No one was putting their plaque on a wall in the church. It was a purely selfless thing. It's unbelievable. So when we think about exploring the Holocaust through a Jewish lens, this is one value that keeps coming up in different contexts, in different ways. certainly from a religious standpoint, when you think about it from a leadership point of view, not everyone, but there were countless, countless examples of rabbis, of leaders, who, even though they could have, they had opportunity, because they were who they were, they had opportunities, but they didn't leave. We'll come back to him now, even though some of you have met him before many times, but especially if you haven't met him, you must meet him. His name was Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapira, the Piasetzner Rebbe, one of the great Hasidic leaders of the Warsaw Ghetto. We've talked about him so many times. When he was transferred to Tronicki, after the ghetto was liquidated, he was in the Schultz shoe factory, and then from the shoe factory, he was transferred to the labor camp at Tronicki, and that's where he was ultimately murdered in November of 1943. But he had a chance to leave. People heard that he was there, but he said he can't leave the people. He had made a pact with a dozen other leaders, figures in this work camp. By the way, not all religious figures, not rabbis, just different people. And they made a pact that they were not going to leave without each other, going to leave as a group. One is not going to abandon the other. And that, to me, it's the most selfless act you can do. Because if somebody sends you a telegram, gets you word that you have papers, you can leave. So focusing on yourself says, I'm going to leave. But to be selfless and to devote yourself to your community, to the people under your care, who probably many of them he had never even met before. Probably most of them were total strangers, because most of his Hasidim, they were all gone. His family was all gone. His students had all been, almost all. We talked before once about the story of the Chicago rabbi, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Meisels, Rabbi Meisels, who settled here in Chicago. Before that, he was in a Hungarian city called Weizen, which is why he was known as the Weizener rabbi. So when he went to Auschwitz in Rosh Hashanah in 1944, so there was a group of students, over 1,000 boys, who were barricaded in this barrack, and they heard that he had a chauffeur, because he had just arrived there, so they still had. So why did he go to that barrack? These boys could never repay him, because you know where they were going the next day. They knew where they were going, and he knew where they was going, where they were going, and he knew that if he went there, if he was caught, he would be killed. So why did he go? It's an act of selflessness. That even though he was endangering his own life, and he knew he would never, there was nothing in it for him, he would never benefit, so to speak. It was a purely selfless act. Just to give them something, even in the waning hours of their life, because they were going to be gassed the next day. Yeah.
Do you think that if he thought that Hashem was going to, honor his mitzvah in heaven, that wasn't totally selfless, he was doing it to do a mitzvah so that he could get... I'm not saying that's why. I'm saying, what is your opinion?
So it's a great question. So it's interesting because in the description, there's an English translation of his recollection of this episode. He said he wonders if the decision to go blow the shofar for these boys, was that in consonance with Jewish law? He wondered maybe that even contravened Jewish law. Because are you allowed to risk your own life just for the mitzvah of shofar?
Didn't want to leave until everyone else.
Yes, exactly. So what is he saying? He's saying there is a, you could argue perhaps what he's alluding to is that there is a meta halachic, there is a fundamental Jewish tenet which is being called upon in these unusual circumstances, even though in ordinary circumstances one would not be permitted to give up their life for the mitzvah of shofar, but there's something different here. And I'm wondering if part of the ingredient here is that concept of selflessness. In Hebrew we call it mesiris nefesh. Limsor means to give over. Nefesh means yourself. So mesiris nefesh means an act of selflessness, an act of self-sacrifice. Yeah.
Did So not at all, to belittle the greatness of the rabbi, but is some of that maybe autopilot in the sense like this is the type of person he is to always give and to always act. And so in the moment, it wasn't really a decision. It was an of course. And it was only after that he maybe like really thought of the implications. Because I feel like so many of these stories, it's not this, like, I sit there and weigh the consequences. I act because that's who I am.
Yes, but how did you become that? How do you become that? Isn't that really what we all want to become? That the intuitive response is a selfless response. And I think that maybe is another way of reframing this, which is in Jewish life, we're always working on ourselves. We're always trying to become our best selves. We are born, and this is maybe one way of thinking about this, we are born according to the tradition. There is a Mishnaic tradition that says that we are born with an evil inclination. That's it, the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, doesn't show up until you become bar or bat mitzvah. And you say, what kind of a deal is that? What an unfair race. So one way to understand that passage in the Mishnah is the following. It doesn't mean that there's a little white guy with a halo and there's a little red guy with a pitchfork, you know? When a child is born with a self-centered perspective on life. Everything is narcissistic. Give me, hold me, feed me. That's what it means to be a child. It's to be totally self-absorbed. As a child grows, when a child starts to mature, when they become bar bat mitzvah, Hashem, so to speak, gives us the Yetzer HaTov. What does it mean? He gives us the developmental capacity to think beyond ourselves. That's why it's so difficult to teach kids to share, because they're so self-absorbed. We know kids who are in their 50s and 60s and 70s who still are in the grips of the Yetzer Hara because it's all revolving around them. It's all self-absorbed. And yet there are people who are growing out of their Yetzer Hara to be that Yetzer HaTov. So that the first Lubavitch Rebbe in the Baal HaTanya, he says that King David describes that it's possible on some level, if you reach such a high level of righteousness, you can eradicate the Yetzer Hara. Now, I don't think that's for the average ordinary person, but what does that mean? It means to be super, super selfless. That you're willing to put yourself out there even though it is compromising your own health and your own well-being and your own success, because you've come to realize that life is about bigger and something more and somebody else, not about yourself. That's the difference between living a narrow, small life of a Yetzer Hara and living the big life of a Yetzer HaTov. So the goal, and you could see it in these rabbis who are models of people who have made that journey and accomplished that level of refinement where they don't see that as a problem. And it's almost like it wasn't even, I mean, he describes that it was a struggle, but for somebody to just make that decision, you have to be so far along in your moral and spiritual development. Your ability to be moser nefesh, your selflessness, is incredible. Yeah.
So this may be a hard question, but I don't have any thoughts about it. Are there any examples of spiritual leaders that went outside of their circle of responsibility on this selflessness? Because we talk about the righteous Gentiles who were amazed at. Do we have any examples at all of the opposite?
Well, what do you mean by that? Because if you're
these stories are, you know, very powerful, but they're the inclination is to help people that are part of your family, that are part of your circle of responsibility. And I'm wondering, is there, and I'm thinking about Rabbi Berman's speech, but that's a different thing, but, you know, who is our brother was the title of it. But are there examples of people that were able to do that? Because we preach to our students here that we want them to be upstanders and all those things. And I keep wondering if I was a gap member in this situation, somebody that I totally didn't know, wasn't part of my religious group, they lived in Chicago, what would I do? And I don't know, you need examples of that.
Right.
Jewish leaders who put themselves out and who died from the civil rights movement.
It's just one recent one. I can't think about the Holocaust. I don't know. It wasn't persecuted.
Exactly. So
Ken Diner. Ken Diner.
That they passed on a highway that was burning and they stopped.
Right. So I'm trying to think about what the formulation of that would look like in the Holocaust context, because like you said, it's... But one way to think about that might be, Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel, maybe this is, again, because in a Jewish tradition, we view all Jews as family. So... I'm trying to think of, in the Holocaust context, maybe you could argue, let's say, a divide between religious Jews and secular Jews. But even there, there are so many examples of, especially survivors, Jews are Jews. If you talk to a survivor, they'll tell you, Jews are Jews. Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel was very involved in rescue efforts, even with non-religious Zionists, which was not the milieu in which he was raised. I'm not sure. I think we would have to go outside of the Holocaust context, let's say, when the state of Israel sends a plane load of soldiers and medical aid to Haiti to help them in the wake of an earthquake, that would be an example of reaching out beyond. I can think more about that. Yeah, Joel.
I think you have to look at the people that not even the figures, people like Anna Korshak. He had the opportunity to leave, to be saved from the ghetto, and he said, I have to stay with my children.
Right. So this idea of selflessness, of the idea of growing to see others, you could argue is the development of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu. Because you know what the verse describes? It says, Vayigdal Moshe, gadol means he became great. What's the immediately following phrase in that verse? Moshe became great, Vayetze el Echav. He went out to the brothers. He went out to his brothers. Meaning, Moses was growing up in the palace. Life is good. What is the mark of greatness? What is Vayigdal? What does it mean to be Gadol? Vayetze el Echav, to go to somebody else, to be selfless. There was a great Hasidic personality, a great rabbinic luminary. He lived in Radomsk in the 19th century. His name is Rav Shlomo Rabinowitz. Rav Shlomo Rabinowitz, because his name was Shlomo, wrote a collection of essays, a work called Tiferes Shlomo, The Beauty of Shlomo. And he talks about two kinds of righteous people, two kinds of tzaddikim. He says you have one righteous person who is very, very pious, very observant, very scrupulous about all of their mitzvot. And that's the focus of their life. But he says there's another kind of tzaddik, another kind of righteous person. And that righteous person is what he calls Doresh Tov La'amo. He borrows a phrase from the story of the Megillah, that person is somebody who's worried about everybody else. Of course, he's pursuing a high spiritual level, but his focus is not in his own piety. His focus is on the other. That's a selfless orientation. It's thinking about where's the locus of my life? Is it here or is that out there? Okay, so this is the idea of selflessness. We're going to find it when we think about the people who were rescuing Jews. We're thinking about leadership who stood up when they could have left. But I want to now pose a challenge to you, because the Talmud has the following scenario. Thanks to Mickey, I am the only one in this room with a bottle of water. And let's say the two of us were stranded in the desert. What should we... Oh, you're right. You have a bottle. So the Talmud wonders, what should happen in the following case? I have the bottle of water, assuming you didn't give it to me for the moment. I have a bottle of water. The two of us are in the middle of the desert. And if I keep the water, I make it to safety. If we split the water, we both die. So what do you do in that case? So one opinion is that you split the water.
Yeah.
But that's not the accepted opinion.
You give the water to the other person.
No, you drink the water.
You drink
it. Why?
You have to preserve yourself.
You got to preserve yourself. So wait a second. We're here talking about selflessness and sacrifice and worrying about other people, and yet the Talmud says, drink the water. Save yourself. How do you square that? Okay, so Vivian says, number one, there's a minimum. Another element is, if we both drink the water and die, that doesn't really help anybody. Okay?
Drink water, maybe you can help the other person.
Maybe. Survive. Oh. But you ready for this? There is a fantastic explanation. I love this explanation. Amazing explanation from Rabbi Shimon Shkop. Rabbi Shkop, he was a great rabbinic authority in Lomja. Some of you are familiar with this town. It's in way up north, not far from Lithuania. It was one of the first major Jewish cities that was overrun by the Germans when they went in. They had a very important yeshiva there. Rav Shimon Shkop established this yeshiva. Rav Shimon Shkop wrote a book that's super complicated, dense, intense Jewish law. In the introduction, he raises this question. He says, I don't understand. He raises it from a different perspective, but it's the same point that we're raising. It says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you love others like you love yourself, and yet, when it's the two of us, I drink it. So he makes the following suggestion, a beautiful idea, and I wonder if this is part of how some of the rescuers or some of the rabbis looked at the situation in terms of how to cultivate selflessness. Says Rav Shimon Shkop, actually, the goal of life is to be selfish, to only worry about yourself. So what's the challenge in life, he says? How to define my sense of self. Of course you have to drink the water, because you always have to preserve yourself, Chayecha Kodman. But when you also think about your spouse or your children, are they other or are they part of me? What about my friends? What about my community? What about all Jews? And then he says, what about all of humanity? He says, the goal is to see all of those concentric circles as part of myself. The way that I'm helping that other person, it's not because it's me and them. It's because, in some level, they're part of me. When you read some of these accounts of people who saved Jews or hid Jews, they say, well, it wasn't about the fact that they were Jewish. It's the fact that we're human. I'm human, and that person's a human. So that's part of my identity. So I save that person. So what turns out is that selfishness and selflessness are not in conflict. What makes somebody selfless, potentially, is the ability to see the other person as really an extension of myself. And that lives on different levels. The Talmud has an expression that when it comes to a spouse, for example, ishto kagufo, a person's spouse is like themselves. It's an extension of themselves. But similarly, the Talmud has an expression like that about children. And it has that same concept of how do we view ourselves. So when we talk about who is the other, so the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, says, imagine you were sitting down to lunch, or Friday night, you were sitting down to your Shabbat table, and you have two challahs, and you take, I don't know, anybody else here, right-handed, left-handed, right-handed. You take the knife in your right hand, I'm holding the challah in my left hand, and by accident, when I go to cut the challah, I cut my finger of my left hand with the knife in my right hand. So the Talmud Yerushalmi asks, would you ever imagine that your left hand is going to slap your right hand? I mean, maybe he should, because the right hand hurt the left hand. Maybe it'll teach him a lesson for next time. But the Talmud says, what are you talking about? It's one organism. So the Talmud says that is, it's a parable, it's an analogy for the Jewish people. If you view that other person as part of yourself, so then of course you're willing to sacrifice yourself in a sense, because it's not somebody else. It's almost not selfless anymore, because that person and I were part of the same body. There's a similar passage in the Midrash describing the Jewish people like one sheep. You know, Moses is a shepherd. It's such a powerful Jewish image. It's because we're all, so it's true. Maybe some of us are the foot of the sheep, and another one is the head, another one is the tail. Maybe, you know, but at the end of the day, especially in a situation like this, the more that we view other people as part of ourselves, we can understand how we can cultivate selflessness, because we have expanded ourselves to include them. If we expand our identity, our definition of self, to include all human beings, so then when people are suffering in Syria or in Africa or, you know, in China with Nebuch, with the coronavirus, it's terrible, 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 lo aleinu. So then we feel that the same way that when my right hand cuts my left hand, so we feel that God's creations are suffering. And that becomes part of my identity rather than looking at them as the other. That's the chap of Reb Shimon Shkab, that your sense of self expands in concentric circles. So if somebody was like the Pia Setzner, a Rebbe in the Warsaw Ghetto, he didn't ask the people who came for encouragement or for advice or for a shoulder to cry on. He didn't say, are you a Pia Setzner Chassid? Were you in my group before? And he didn't ask whether the guy was religious or the woman was not religious, or she comes from Poland or from Hungary. What's the difference? We're all together. That's really the question. And so maybe this also brings us back to that statement of Hillel, of Im ein ani li mili, who is going to be for me? Uchashani la atzmi moani. Now we're saying uchashani la atzmi. When my ani, what does the word ani mean in Hebrew? I. When my I is just la atzmi, is just myself, then ma'ani, what am I? I'm so narrow. But if my I, when I say the word I, it means all of us, so then I'm a somebody. I have to be for I. I have to drink the water first before somebody else. But who's the I in this story? That's the question that we ask ourselves. And maybe this is part of what we're thinking about, when, especially when we are taking people through the museum. A lot of the folks you're going to take through the museum, they've never met Jews. They don't know anything about Jews. So they're viewing Jews as the other. And a lot of these people we're taking through, we don't know them. You know, we're very different from them. But the question of, well, A, what is your orientation? What would you be willing to do for somebody else? Just the simple question of, are we selfish or selfless? And where are we on that continuum? Because it's not a binary, I'm selfish or selfless. It's a continuum. I'm growing. I'm moving from my Yetzer Hara to my Yetzer Tov. You know, I'm moving from being self-absorbed to being selfless, to being other-focused. So that's one question that we're asking, selfish or selfless. But the other way of looking at this, which I think is so interesting when you talk about selflessness, has to do with how do we define ourselves versus the other? Why do they become other? Just because they speak a different language? Just because they practice their religion differently than I practice my religion? You know, what makes them other? And what are we willing to do? What can we accomplish when we stop saying other and we start saying my I is more than atzmi, than myself? What possibilities can be accomplished when we start redefining ourselves? Endless. And I think that's something that I think people can think about, and you can foster that kind of conversation, I suspect. There are so many examples when you go through this journey of people who were A, selfless, and B, were able to incorporate others into their identity. So be able to see themselves as bigger than they were. You know, caring for total strangers. You know, look at the, we've spoken about it before, and with this I'll end. We've spoken about the Klosenberger Rebbe, Rev Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam. So this was a man who, he had 11 children. 10 of them were taken with his wife to Auschwitz. So he came from Romania. They were all, at the end of the war, they were all gone. Then he had one son who survived almost to the end of the war, who then died just at the end of the war. So now here he is in a DP camp. Zero. Nobody. Nobody, nobody. So what does he do? He does both of the things that we're talking about. He devotes himself to the community. What community? The survivors. These broken souls, these broken Jews. How to talk to them, rehabilitate them, give them some Jewish context. So he's selfless, but he's also defining them as his own. They become his family, they become his children, they become his students, even though none of them were his students from before. But now they became his students. Because his sense of self includes all these people. He was the kind of tzaddik who was a tzaddik for everyone. He was worried about everybody. So you know that amazing story about when Eisenhower came to Feldafing on Yom Kippur in 1945, so he says, he wants to talk to him. He didn't speak English. He only spoke Yiddish, so they had a translator. He says, can you help our people? Can you bring us Sidurim, Machzorim? Then he says, can you bring us the four species? So they had an American military plane fly from Italy, where you can get citrus in October, to Germany, so that they could have the four species for Sukkot. But it wasn't for him. It's for the other. I'll tell you one last story. How many stories can I say are one of my favorites? But I'll say it anyway. If I'm not mistaken, sometimes I get these names wrong, but I believe it was the Skulena Rebbe and the Vizhnitsa Rebbe after the war in a DP camp somewhere. The Skulena Rebbe got a hold of wheat and was baking matzahs. So it was obviously a very unusual circumstance. And they decided that they were going to send a message to other rabbis that the Skulena Rebbe was going to bake matzahs and then distribute matzahs to the other rabbis in any nearby towns or DP camps, whatever they can get a hold of. So this was like 2 weeks before Pesach. Like, imagine 3 weeks' time. So the Vizhnitsa Rebbe's son, or Gabbai, I don't remember, comes to the Skulena Rebbe, and he says, I'd like to pick up a matzah for my father, for my Rebbe, for the Vizhnitsa. So the Gabbai of the Skulena Rebbe, his associate, his helper, says, sure, I'll go get you a matzah. So he says, I'm sorry, but my father, my Rebbe, the Vizhnitsa, insisted that I take home two matzahs. So meanwhile, this Gabbai, he's thinking, what a chutzpah. I can't even do the temerity, the gall, the insolence. You know what's going on over here? We barely have anything to eat. We don't have matzahs for anybody. You're lucky you're going to get one matzah from the Skulena Rebbe, hand-baked matzah. You're asking for two matzahs? Are you out of your mind? He says, I have to tell you, I'm sorry. But the Vizhnitsa said, I cannot come home without two matzahs for the Seder. So the guy says, I don't know what to tell you. There's no two matzahs over here, but I'll ask the Skulena Rebbe myself if I can take two matzahs and give them to you. So he goes to the Skulena, and the Skulena, they discussed, they feel very awkward, but the Vizhnitsa was a great, super person. So they fine, we'll give him two matzahs. Erev Pesach in the afternoon, 2 hours before Pesach, there's a knock on the door of the Skulena. And here it is, this Gabbai from the Vizhnitsa Rebbe. And you can imagine, he didn't get the warmest welcome from the Gabbai of the Skulena. Amazing. So the Gabbai of the Vizhnitsa says, I had to bring you something. The physician said, I had to deliver you something. And he gives him a little bag, and inside the bag is a matzah. The vision, Sir Gabai said, my father said to tell you, to tell the schoolener, I knew that when it came down to it, he would give away every matzah that he would have and would have no matzah for his own Seder. So he says, here is a matzah for your Seder. Is that an unbelievable story? Mm-hmm. To understand the great... First of all, the Vishnitzer Rebbe was obviously a tremendously smart person to have that insight, to be ahead of the game. And I have more stories like that. But to understand that the Shkulener Rebbe was so focused on the other, was so selfless, that he would give away... Even though he baked these matzahs, they were so precious to him. But... he would give them all away. He would have no matzahs at his own table so that other Jews could have matzahs. That the Vishnitzer Rebbe knew enough to insist on two matzahs because he knew that's how great the Shkulener was. He knew that's the kind of person that he was. It's that kind of a tzaddik, of a leader who they're just devoted to everybody else. That at the end of the day, what I have doesn't matter at all. It's all about the others. That's the ultimate in selflessness, in mesiris, in being devoted to the others. That's the model that you see so many times through these incredibly heroic stories. And that's a value that we can try in our own small way to incorporate into our own lives. It's a tall task, but hopefully we'll continue to live up to it. Yeah. Yes.
So he gives away all his matzah. And meanwhile, in the desert, you're drinking your water.
Exactly.
I don't understand.
Exactly, because it's the same point. It's very much like that experience of the Weizner Rav in Auschwitz. Maybe in certain circumstances, according to the letter of the law of the Talmud, you drink the water. But these rabbis, they were going to go beyond what it says in the law. That's why he says, I'm not really sure if legally I'm supposed to go blow the shofar for that boy, those boys, the 1,000 boys in the barracks or not. But my soul is telling me I must do that for them. Of course, technically speaking, the schoolener was supposed to keep a matzah. This is his mitzvah matzah. But his soul told him, I'm going to sit and eat matzah when other Jews have no matzah. I'll have the merit of them eating the matzah. I can't tell you what he was thinking, but that's what I'm reconstructing in my mind. Because someone whom the midah, the character trait of selflessness is so ingrained in them, that's the kind of person they become. That same passage from Rav Shimon Shkab says that's why, in his opinion, that's why God tells Jews to be holy. What does it mean, Kadoshim to you? What does it mean to be holy? There are lots of different interpretations. He quotes three. He says, I'll tell you, I think the interpretation means to me to be like God. And God is the epitome of altruism. He creates this world. He doesn't need it. If we do positive deeds, it doesn't help him in any way. God doesn't need our prayers. He doesn't need our acts of chesed, kindness. He doesn't need that. He does because he wants to give, so to speak, whatever that means. So, says Rabbi Shkab, he says, if we want to be like the divine, then our job is to be as altruistic as possible, as selfless as possible. And there's a midrashic teaching that says that don't think you're ever going to be as altruistic as God, because God can be 100% altruistic and you can be 99.7% altruistic. But that's the goal. And so, yes, it's actually a Jewish law conundrum that on the one hand, legally, technically speaking, you drink your own water. But what the rabbis are telling us is that sometime in certain circumstances, you transcend even that normative law, because the value of selflessness and the circumstances are such that that's going to trump even what would be the rule in regular cases, even to give away his own matzah. But again, the greatest thing is that the Vishnitzer knew he would give away the matzahs because he knew he was such a selfless person. Could you imagine? Is there anybody who could say about someone else, do you know somebody who you know would give the shirt off their back? You think of that person, like, that is the epitome of selflessness. So you're going to relate to that person knowing they'll give you. You're not going to ask them for it. Because if you ask them for it, you know they're going to give it to you. You know, you would only ask them if you are absolutely desperate. Because you have such confidence in their selflessness. That's the story of this school.
Why did he ask him for it? Is it a test? Why did he ask him for all his money?
He asked him for the two matzahs because he wanted to give it back to him on the day before Pesach so that the Schelener would have matzah.
Why? I don't understand.
So what? Right. So just to make sure. So he purposely took two matzahs. The Vizhnitzer took two matzahs, knowing that the Schelener would have no matzah, and sent his guy back on Erev Pesach so that the Schelener would have a matzah.
Well, why go through? I don't understand. Why put someone through that?
Because he's saying that the Schelener was so generous, he knew that he would not have any matzahs left.
But why ask him for two? Why can't you? Why shouldn't you just ask him for one?
Because if you would have asked him for one,
if he asked for one, then one rabbi would have had one and the other rabbi would have had
one. No, but he would have given it away.
He would have given it away.
Yes! That's it. That's it. That's exactly it. That's good, yeah. But that's the point. He was so generous, he would have given it away, and that's what. He's like the insurance. He's matzah insurance to make sure that the Schelener had a matzah. Yeah.
This topic, and it's not to say it's not this topic. So we have read and heard stories of rabbis who, like, give, kind of say it's okay to not eat kosher, and then they during this time period, but then they themselves didn't.
Right.
You know, they tell people to go ahead and eat on Pesach, but then they themselves hold back, and didn't always work out so well for some of them.
Well,
so is that a selflessness, knowing that they're sustaining life for others, or like, or is
that's
that,
more
this is a different topic?
Well, that's more a question of what's beyond the letter of the law and every person knowing their spiritual stature. So, like the Klosenberger, he had a turban on his face, faking an illness because he didn't want to shave his beard. So, like, that's not the letter of the law. That's his standing for his level of spiritual resistance where he was, as opposed to for other people, what is the regular, what is Hashem asking of the average ordinary person? So that's a little bit different than the question of, selflessness. Yeah, Ina.
Going back to what Mickey had asked about the intuitiveness, I want to sort of clarify it in my own mind. So, is it, if you're saying that children are self-absorbed until they get to be bad,
we hope they we hope they mature.
And
we try to educate.
Is selflessness an intuitive trait that is nurture?
Yes.
And that is, it comes through maturation, or can it be taught to be? Because, you know, on my tour, I talk about the others, and we're all people, and the respect for everybody. And I think the inference I'm trying to make is that, now that I'm using these terms, selflessness and whatever, not to be a selfish person, but to be an upstander is a selfless person. So, is that I'm understanding that I can teach it?
You can or cannot, you say?
I can.
You certainly can. But in the
but
following...
But some of us, in special adult people, it's an intuitive trait.
Well, I would argue like this. Every human being is endowed with a spark of godliness. That's how we're alive. We exist because we have a soul. It's not through our body. You could take a very talented surgeon, cut someone up in 10 pieces, sew them back together. Their organs will look exactly as they did before, but they won't get off the table because their soul has departed. That soul, that spark of holiness, is an expression, it's a mirror of Hashem, of godliness. And if God is altruistic. That means that we, each one of us deep down, has that tiny spark of selflessness, of altruism, of the vision of something bigger. And the goal of life is to make that tiny little spark into a huge flame that illuminates all of our life. So, of course, it's a little bit of both. Yes, there may be some people who are endowed, just like there are some people who are endowed with a lot of patience. There are some people who are endowed with a greater sense of selflessness, but we're all endowed with a soul. And so our job in life is to cultivate that and nurture it. So we can be taught to recognize that we have that. It's like teaching children to share, you know, or teaching adults to share. It's something that we have the capacity within us. We have that godly ability to be selfless. We just have to nurture it. We can't bury it. There are some people who have a spark of selflessness and they totally bury it and they live self-absorbed narcissistic lives from day one until 120, and that's the end of their story. And that's it. It's a shame. But there are people who make that choice. We're encouraging people to make the choice to say, bring out your inner godliness. Bring out your inner spiritual core, which is selfless. That's altruistic. That's what you're teaching people. Yeah,
so this is also a phase by the Jewish soul that you and I have talked about.
Yes. It's related to the Jewish soul, but it's also related to the human spirit, because every human has that spark of God. That means that every human being has the capacity for altruism. And look at these examples. These people who are not Jewish or Christian or not religious at all, and they tap into this inner, you know, where does it come from? This inner inspiration to risk their own lives, to help Jews, to put a kid in their basement and to nurture that child for years. It's amazing. Yeah, Joel, last comment, and then we'll...
To me, I see somewhat of a dichotomy here, because the Talmud says, what's more important, preserve the self or preserve the whole? You know, there's a famous Star Trek scene where Spock has killed himself because he's... I don't know if you're a Trekkie or not.
No, that was never my thing.
The other workshop is about to start, so
that's okay.
What they were knocking.
Okay.
All right, so, you know, what he says, so, what's more important...